Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to CSIS. I wish I could tell you that the timing of this particular event was something we had with great foresight and sagacity worked out in advance. But I think it's actually more luck than skill. However, the skill part of it comes in having persuaded Ambassador Haqqani to spend an afternoon with us. I have known Ambassador Haqqani for many years. He was an energetic political operative in Pakistan when I first knew him. And then our second opportunity to spend some time together came when he was Pakistan's High Commissioner in Sri Lanka, and I arrived as U.S. Ambassador. He went back to Pakistan rather dramatically about 6 or 8 months later, and the next thing we knew, he was a Minister of State in the Pakistan government. He was, of course, as many of you know, living in Washington and then in Boston for a number of years during the Musharraf years. And he has now returned once again. I like to think of it as his having come home to be Pakistan's ambassador in Washington. We certainly have a dramatic time to welcome him here. I'd like to acknowledge the presence of at least one former U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, John Manjo. If there are others who managed to sneak in without my noticing them, I apologize. I'd also like to acknowledge my colleagues, Rick Barton, here on the podium, the co-director of the Post-Conflict Resolution Project, and Arno de Borgrav, sitting frightfully discreetly in the front row. But rather than take any more of your time, I would like to turn the floor over to Ambassador Haqqani, who months ago picked the topic of managing Pakistan's transition, and it couldn't be more appropriate for today. After he finishes his remarks, Rick and I will exercise the prerogative of being up here to ask the first couple of questions, and then we will open it up to the floor. When we get to that point, I will ask each of you, and Rick will be kind enough to remind you, to identify yourselves and your affiliation and to wait for the microphone to get to you before you ask your question. So without further ado, Hussein Haqqani, thank you for being here, and we're eager to hear from you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Schaefer. It is an interesting coincidence that we are meeting on a day when the interest in developments in Pakistan is at an all-time high. There are hardly days in any year when interest in Pakistan is low in Washington, at least not in recent years. Ambassador Schaefer pointed out, we had scheduled this event quite some time ago, not knowing that it will be the day that it is, that actually we will be talking about Pakistan's transition on a day when Pakistan's transition has moved one more step forward. There was a tendency that I used to have, I don't know if you remember, Ambassador Schaefer, when we were in Sri Lanka, of citing Urdu poetry, and then, of course, Ambassador Schaefer knows Urdu, but sometimes translating it into English. So there's a poem by, or a couplet by, one of Pakistan's sort of most important poets of the latter half of the 20th century, Munir Niazi, which runs something like this, that every time I cross a river, I have another river to cross. And that is the way Pakistan's politics moves forward. It is important to understand that the stage at which Pakistan finds itself today is unique in many, many ways. Now, there are people here who are hardened Pakistan watchers, and many of them will have the same cynicism that there has been before. Pakistan has had a long history of alternating civilian and military rule. And so there are those who have already called me up and said, oh, so this is another phase. But there are many things that are distinct. For one thing, a military ruler who came to office through a coup d'etat has left office without a coup d'etat. Second, a transition is taking place in which the military has not anointed anyone as its favorite, and the military is genuinely visibly and invisibly being totally neutral in the domestic political arena. These are important distinctions. And they are the result of a long process of hard think on the part of Pakistanis. President Musharraf's rule was an important phase in Pakistan's life because it was in some ways the culmination of certain generalities about Pakistan. Pakistan's politicians are venal, they are prone to corruption and patronage politics, the politics is all about families and relationships, etc. An elite view of Pakistan has been formed over the last many decades. Pakistan doesn't have a very long history. It's a six-decade history. But in these 6 decades, I call it the Ayubian view. As a scholar, I used to call it the Ayubian view of Pakistan. Ayub Khan, when he intervened, he created this view that the military was the final arbiter of things in Pakistan, or should be, and that basically Pakistan's problems were those of management, not of politics. Well, history has proven that governance is essentially a function of politics. So you cannot have apolitical governance. But a lot of people, and this is a very Washington view, partly because how Washington gets his view of Pakistan. Most of the people who have historically explained Washington to Pakistan to Washington have essentially been retired military officers, retired civil servants, bankers who work for American corporate, for the international banking system here, people who work for the World Bank and the IMF. All of them, by definition, managers. None of them are politicians. So there has been a tendency here to see Pakistan's politics from the prism of those who think that Pakistan's politics is inherently flawed. My one-liner on that is, name me a country whose politics is not inherently flawed. I am planning to go and attend the Democratic National Convention, and I'm sure I'll learn a thing or two about how politics is difficult, how people keep grudges, how they are divided by factions. Even the historic evolution of American democracy, I mean, there are the issue of corruption, I've debated that in this city for the last 7 years with many people, and now I'm looking a little better to myself, at least, some vindication. I've always argued that Pakistan's politics, or at least the popular support base of Pakistan's politicians, is not going to erode just because a group of professionals and technocrats goes and works with the military or a military leader to try and change things from the top. It's just not going to happen until and unless the process just goes on. Just as the free market economy, people would argue, Adam Smith argued, and now Alan Greenspan argues, that you just have to give it time, the process works it out. Politics is also a kind of a marketplace in which things go in a certain way. You have to have a Richard Nixon, you have to have an impeachment, and then you have to have the reforms that will come as a result of that whole process of debate about Watergate. And Pakistan has not had that opportunity because Pakistan's pyramid has a very narrow apex, and that apex, people that most people in this room know, they all have historically debated, argued, discussed, and found a solution. And that solution has always been imperfect. So this time, what has changed in Pakistan, and this is the real transition in Pakistan, is a broad national consensus that Pakistan needs to move forward with constitutional democracy, with a political process, with warts and all. There will be difficulties. There will be politicians who will not necessarily make correct choices. But the old paradigm that Allah, America, and the army, the three A's, everyone's heard that cliche, I'm sure. Is there anybody in this audience who's so innocent that they've never heard that one? That cliche now needs to be set aside. And yes, we will have a lot of bargaining. We will have flawed politicians talking to other flawed politicians. After all, they may not be that flawed. There must be a reason why people vote for them. There is a reason why their constituents like them. So point number one is that there is a national consensus in Pakistan on democracy. And that consensus is fully now supported by the Pakistani military as well. The Pakistani military has scrupulously this time avoided any overt or covert role in Pakistan's politics. And that's a very important positive. The election of February 18 could not have been as free and fair as it was if the military had not been completely neutral. It was the intelligence services that in the past used to tilt the balance in favor of one politician or another and create balances within parliament that did not play a role that made it possible for the two major parties opposed to President Musharraf, former President Musharraf, I feel so good saying that, former President Musharraf, that is what made it possible for the parties opposed to him to have the victory they did on February 18. Now, the transition is a challenge. So there is consensus, there's a desire to make it work, but there are difficulties. The very fact that there is a coalition government means that there has to be a lot more give and take. And to some people, the give and take comes more readily than to others. Some people think that being stubborn is the same thing as being principled. And so you will have those people being difficult in the process of the negotiation of compromises. Plus, those in Washington who have become accustomed to the notion of talk to one person and get whatever you want, they will find it difficult to deal with plural centers of power. Instead of one phone call, there will at least have to be three phone calls each time. And so some people will find that exhausting. But that said, it may perhaps be better for Pakistan for the simple reason that instead of arbitrary and sudden changes of policy that may or may not suit the United States at different times, now the process of policy making in Pakistan will have an internal dynamic that will be complex. And once decisions are made, the likelihood that those decisions will be fully implemented will be far greater. So, to answer the simple journalistic question that sometimes is posed to me, has been posed a lot in the last 24 hours or 48 hours, is the removal of President, the resignation of President Musharraf, something that should be seen in Washington or anywhere in the world as a loss? And my answer to that is no. It is not a loss. It's nobody's loss. It's an opportunity. It's an opportunity for Pakistan to build a stable democratic order. It's an opportunity for the Pakistani military to prove that while it is sucked into coups by some military leader, look, there have been several military chiefs who have not taken power in coups d'etat. But some have. And the ones who have always ended up becoming sort of autocratic rulers surrounded by sycophants and friends and supporters, not necessarily fully supported by the military as an institution. Ayub Khan, same thing happened. In fact, he was removed by the military. He handed over power to his successor in the military. General Ziaul Haq, also, in his last days, does not have the institutional support of the military anymore. I mean, the military was not willing to topple him, but the military was not willing to take responsibility for everything that he did. And so, therefore, when the election of 1988 was held, the military tried to distance itself from General Ziaul Haq's legacy, while at the same time trying, General Aslam Beg tried to implement some of it through his own personal action and because of his own personal involvement. This time, the military's role is much above board and sort of distant. It is not for us to get involved in politics. And that puts the politicians on the mat. They have to perform. Pakistan's political leaders have to show their ability to compromise. They have to show their ability to run an effective government and to leave functioning institutions, civilian institutions, that can then be improved further by their successors. So the real test of Pakistan's transition will be President Musharraf has resigned, threatened by impeachment. The elected government is now in a position to be able to do something for the country. And yet there are checks and balances within the political system. There is opposition within the government. There's a coalition within which there are parties that have less or are willing to go along with less less of the decision making and are willing to act as an opposition. And then there is a free and lively media, perhaps too free sometimes, too free in the sense, as I keep telling the story, Ambassador Ann Patterson was in Washington for Prime Minister Gilani's visit, and then she stayed on for a few days. And she was visiting with me at the Embassy of Pakistan, and I had one of the Pakistani television channels on. And on that channel, the scroll was running at that time, the little ticker, which said, Ambassador Ann Patterson meets Mr. Asif Zardari in Islamabad, while she was meeting with me in Washington, D.C. So that's the extent of the what I consider freedom of the press in Pakistan, which is much better than when Benazir Bhutto returned in 1986 and Pakistan Times, the official newspaper at that time, did not report it. In fact, their lead story that day, when several hundred thousand people at least received Benazir Bhutto in Lahore in 1986, the lead story of Pakistan Times and Pakistan Television Evening News was not her return, but the visit of the Maltese president to Islamabad. So it's gone 180 degrees. It's very different. But the media will also mature with time. And so Pakistan's transition is going to be a tricky and a difficult act. But I think Pakistan has to go through this transition. It is part of the process of maturity. Quite often, people have talked about stability versus autocracy. I use a new sort of dichotomy. I don't know how new it is, but to me it's new. And that is stability versus certainty. And let me explain this. Pakistan's neighbor to the east, they have had long phases of instability, of state governments that are in conflict with the federal government, of violence in certain states and difficulties in other, of insurgencies, this, that, etc. But there have been certain certainties about them also. There has been a certainty that the country is going to remain, that they will have changes of government through a democratic process. Even after the emergency was imposed by Indira Gandhi, Indira Gandhi's removal did not come about through military intervention or a coup d'etat. It came about through an election. And the process went on. Pakistan has not had certainty. We've had these long periods of stability where the lid has been put on, and you know, Musharraf's period was cited as a period of tremendous stability for a few years. And people like me who were critics used to make this argument, and there are some of you who may, people with good memories in this room will remember, I have made this argument over and over again, that this is going to wither, this is going to pass, for the simple reason that the fundamentals are not there. The legitimacy question will arise someday. You can't have a government lacking in legitimacy doing quote-unquote good things. Even in his farewell address, the former president listed his achievements in a kind of a technocratic criteria, you know, miles of roads built, schools built, you know, economic growth rates, this, that, etc. All of which are important. But I think nations to come together also need a fundamental certainty about their own direction and their future. And I think that certainty will only come through democracy. So Pakistan may have a period of some limited, not instability, but less predictability than before. But it will have much more certainty because, after all ethnic groups are represented in government. All religious groups are represented in parliament, and a general decision by consensus of the people of Pakistan is enforced that Pakistan needs to be together for the purpose of the advancement of its people. What does this have? And I'm sure that that's a question somebody will have in their mind. What does this transition mean for critical things like Pakistan's economy and Pakistan's cooperation with the United States in the war against terror? Let me take the question of the war against terror first. I think it's very important to understand that the major political parties that will now run Pakistan with a relatively freer hand than ever before, they have a consensus on fighting terrorism for Pakistan's sake. Very different from the 9/11 turnaround, which was based on, and I think that the former president said as much in his book, that he made a cold calculation about what was advantageous for him and his government and for his country at that time, and he decided that it was better to work with the United States when the choice was given, are you with us or against us? He said, I'd rather be with you than be against you. But it wasn't a matter of conviction that, very frankly, militancy, terrorism, and non-state actors wielding coercive power or tremendous ability to engage in violence, that they are actually not in Pakistan's interest. I think that that consensus exists in Pakistan's parliament. In the election of February 18, those who ran on the platform of, you know what, the Taliban aren't that bad, didn't win. They got less than 5% of the vote. The largest vote getter, the Pakistan People's Party, actually ran on a platform of anti-terrorism and lost its leader, Shahid Benazir Bhutto, to terrorism. So I think that there is a greater clarity in Pakistan right now about the need to fight terrorism. Now, immediately after the elected government came in, there was a little confusion about, you know, why are they negotiating, etc. Well, politics has its own course. And I have said this many times, I used to say it to my students when I was teaching at Boston University and before that at SAIS, that there's a problem that everybody in the USA and in Washington understands that all politics is local, except when it relates to US foreign policy. Then everybody in this town wants other countries to forget about their local politics and just do whatever, you know, the big wigs and the smart alecks and the think tanks and the State Department and whatever else the machinery of decision making in this city is. They should just fall in line because that's what's more important right now. Well, no, there is a local dynamic, and the local dynamic of politics required that there be a process of engagement so that the government could make the argument that there are certain people who are irreconcilable. Before you can use coercive power against your own people or elements that people consider to be your own people, you have to make the case persuasively that these people are really the ones who just simply cannot be reconciled. And so that is the reason why we are moving against them. And now we've seen in the last 2 weeks military action in Khyber, in Bajor, and I think that a methodical military strategy developed by the civilians and fully backed by the military will come into force. And it may not be as effective sounding at first glance as the pronouncements of the past. There are some people who have made the observation that Pakistani politicians, who are primarily domestic politicians, don't present or articulate their case as well in Washington as, say, for example, our former Prime Minister, a stalwart of Citibank, was able to do, or our military ruler was able to do. But the point is that they are better able to garner support from the people of Pakistan. And so Pakistan is in a new phase of looking for strength at home rather than projecting effectiveness abroad without having effectiveness at home. And that will be good for the war against terror, because it will enable the Pakistani military to conduct operations with the backing of an elected civilian government without questions about legitimacy being raised. Until now, there's been a legitimacy question on everything, whether it was the Red Mosque incident or whether it was operations in Fata, etc. There were all the questions. So now we will be able to get a broader-based strategy to fight terrorism. And I think that that will manifest itself. We have a few hurdles to cross. There is the Musharraf legacy the questions of legitimacy pertaining to General Musharraf will move on a little bit, because there are some people who are baying for his blood and others who believe that putting things behind and moving forward is more important. So I think we will see some negotiation on that. There is the judges' question that needs to be resolved. Again, another question that splits the two major coalition partners down the middle on what is the right course. But these issues will also be resolved through a process of give and take and negotiation, because after all, the methodology of decision making has been determined. I personally, and I'm not much of a betting man, but I'm quite willing to bet that General Musharraf's coup was Pakistan's last military coup. I think that no one in Pakistan, including those in Pakistan's military, are desirous of putting Pakistan down the road of Myanmar, for example. The Pakistani military wants to be an institution that is supported by the people of Pakistan. And I think that the Pakistani military, working with the civilians rather than at cross purposes, is going to be good for the war against terror and for Pakistan's institutional evolution and development. Second, the economy. Well, again, what we had in the last few years was, again, a top-down economic strategy in which growth was important. And I'm not saying growth is not important, but a former chief economist of Pakistan's Planning Commission, who served until last year, has now come out and written a very extensive piece on the debates within the Shaukat Aziz administration about the Pakistani economy. And here's what he says. He says, basically, many of the decision-makers were essentially people who thought that achieving high growth through increased consumption is desirable. So Pakistan's production didn't go up, consumption went up. And basically, Pakistan started out with 10 or 11 banks in 1999. It has more than 40 commercial banks now. More commercial banks. More commercial banks means more loans available. So, you know, every time they would cite that, look, the number of cars in Pakistan is increasing, so the country is becoming more prosperous. Well, yes, they were increasing because there was more credit available for people to buy cars without enough being put into broadening the roads, etc., not enough being put into the infrastructure. And agricultural growth has hovered between 1.5% to 2.5%. That's been the agricultural growth rate, the sector that employs the maximum number of people. But because, you know, I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to sort of call that Enron economics, but, you know, there is an ability on the part of some people to make it all look very good, and it was. But the fact is that the fundamentals were not as good as it was being argued. So once the oil prices skyrocketed, there was no cushion. Once the food prices went up, there was no cushion. And then for a year and a half, the oil prices were not passed on to the people to create a political cushion for a government that was already embattled. And so the new government has inherited this whole sort of deficit that has come from skyrocketing oil prices and a subsidized oil, and that is being dealt with right now. Similarly, high food prices and low growth in agriculture and inadequate growth in Pakistan's manufacturing, which has then affected Pakistan's ability to expand its exports. They've kind of plateaued. You can't have exports unless you have things to export. And by definition, again, the politicians are going to be better at handling this for the simple reason that the PPP's constituents are Pakistan's farmers. They have to invest in agriculture to get the votes again the second time around. And Mr. Sharif's constituents are the urbanized elites who are essentially the industrial sort of the beneficiaries of Pakistan's industrialization or semi-industrialization. So just by constituency politics, even if they were just engaging in patronage politics, they would have to make the agriculture and the industry of the country work, which wasn't the case with people who had come without an economic manifesto, without a plan. Musharraf just took power because he was about to be ousted, and he sort of made up a plan as he went along. He didn't have a plan against terrorism. He just made it after 9/11. And the same applies to the economic side, that basically it was, okay, let's find a few economists, you know, who's in Washington, who's in New York, call them in, let's put it together, whatever they can come up with, as long as it all looks good. Now there is going to be a homegrown strategy for economic development, which will focus on agriculture, which will focus on manufacturing, which will improve and expand Pakistan's exports. And I think that is a positive thing. So on the whole, will there be a lot of news stories in the New York Times about Pakistan on crossroads? Plenty. politicians squabble absolutely. Disagreements in parliament on this and that, definitely. But will this all work out in a better way generally for Pakistan and for Pakistan's friends abroad? I think that it will. And I think I have made a decent case for why. I'm happy to take questions because I'm sure that there are a lot of questions that I have created and a lot of questions that are already in your minds. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, Hussein, for a spirited and thought-provoking presentation, as we knew we would get from you. I'm going to let my colleague Rick ask the first question, and then I will do the next, and then we will give the audience a chance. Okay,
thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador. I think you've done your job well so far. I think we're all worried, obviously, that there is the potential for more of the same is great. And there's just a tremendous amount of unfinished business that's unclear how it's going to be addressed, from the judges to the corruption charges or the amnesties to the Red Mosque, the Karachi incidents. And so finding a way for a democracy to deal with these things that satisfies the public curiosity but also has a sense of fair play has obviously been one of the challenges of Pakistan for the last several decades. And I think it really will set the tone for whether it will be a country where rule of law is a central part of your future or not, and whether it will be a reliable ally in many, many other ways. Clearly, when you go to Balochistan or you go up to the Northwest, there are people who are doubtful that the establishment, whether it's the three A's that you describe or whether it's more nuanced as they would, will in fact be able to deliver this. And so dealing with this kind of pending business, in particular the judge issue, I think, and is really at the forefront of it, may give us an indication of whether we're moving forward. I guess the second part of that question is the real change within the military. Some would say that the military is chastened, that they're in hiding, that they've suffered for their greed and incompetence over the last period of time, not just through Musharraf. And so what's the sign of sincerity that they have truly changed, rather than just recouping their strength at this point?
Thank you, Rick, for your 9 questions. Let me begin with the question of the judges. I don't think that there is any Pakistani except a handful, and according to the last polling data, there were about 9% people who had a positive view of the former president, so that's about 9% of the population that really thinks that the dismissal of Supreme Court and High Court judges last year was not wrong. I think that there is consensus on the fact that Pakistan must have an independent judiciary. I think all major political parties in Pakistan agree on the restoration of the judiciary that was dismissed by General Musharraf. The question is how. And on that, there is a disagreement between Mr. Nawaz Sharif's party and the Pakistan People's Party and several other parties that support the PPP on this subject. What can be a solution? I don't think that certain issues can be argued incessantly. I think they have to at some point be resolved through a process. And the democratic process would be through a vote in parliament eventually. I mean, they will try to negotiate. They are working together. After all, it's a coalition, and coalition leaders talk, negotiate, work out. But in the end, if they cannot agree on the modalities, then eventually there will have to be a vote. And I think here it's important to remember that somebody has more votes than the other, and that is a very democratic that's a very democratic outcome. We may not agree with the people who have more votes than us. Living in this country, I now know how some people can sometimes sort of hold the argument. There are still bumper stickers that talk about the 2000 election. But the truth is that that's how democracies move forward. Otherwise, you can have an endless argument. So if certain lawyers and certain politicians refuse to accept the agree the decision of the majority of the members of parliament, that doesn't mean that that is not what will prevail. The judiciary will be restored, I think, and Pakistan will now have an independent judiciary. But will the restoration be to the process of restoration be exactly what certain lawyers as leaders and certain political leaders want? I don't think that that is even necessary for Pakistan to move forward. It may be one of those arguments that you just lose and move on. On the other question of the military, I think we have to understand this is something that people do not, when you do not go into, when you just look at the macro picture without looking at the micro details, then you sometimes miss out certain important facts. It's very important to understand what has changed. People marched in the streets of Pakistan for 5 months to topple Ayub Khan, the first military ruler, Field Marshal Ayub Khan. But it was a campaign against Field Marshal Ayub Khan. And when he left, the military took over and the people were quite satisfied with it. They said, yeah, the military's come in, they'll hold a free and fair election and things will move on, by and large. Yahya Khan held elections, and that's how he managed to justify his existence, that, you know, I am going to hold elections, free and fair elections. And he held free and fair elections, and then we all know the history after that. East Pakistan was lost, it became Bangladesh, and Yahya Khan was forced to hand over power because there was no alternative. I think that one of the things that has changed is that the open or relatively more open debate in Pakistan has brought into question the military's role in Pakistan's politics. And a lot more debate has taken place. And that has made soldiers wonder, look, when Musharraf took power, Musharraf came in as the army chief. The army as an institution got blamed for everything he did. But the truth is that it was just a small coterie that was running the country, not the entire army. So the average colonel and the average captain and the average lieutenant and the average major was not necessarily the person who was making the decisions, yet he was getting the blame. I think that the military realizes that. And I think it's up to the civilians to make sure that it continues to realize that. Last but not least, the international environment has changed considerably. In 1958, when Ayub Khan took power, there, you know, almost two-thirds of the world's governments were military regimes of one form or another, or at least, 60% or so. Latin America was all sort of military regimes, etc. Even General Musharraf used to feel this. I mean, he made tremendous efforts. I remember when he gave instructions that he should be referred to as President Musharraf and not as General Musharraf. You know, even while he was still general, he was serving general, he was refusing to take off his uniform. But whenever he visited the United States, he never wore his general's uniform. I don't know if anybody noticed that. It was always a nice Armani suit. And so... The reason is because even he realized that civilian rulers have greater legitimacy than military rulers and certainly coup makers. And I think that that is a reality that has dawned in Pakistan. Now, does that mean that every man in the Pakistani army has stopped thinking about how the army is the only institution that has the right to run Pakistan? Possibly not. But I think that the circumstances are there for the civilians to push the envelope and make sure that there is a broad national consensus that the army's role is national security, that it is the defender of Pakistan's frontiers, and that the politicians have the job of running the country. And if the politicians have flaws and weaknesses, there are methods to remove them and bring others who will also have flaws and weaknesses, and you just go through that process. You have to have alternation in power through a democratic process. And I think that decision has been taken collectively by Pakistanis, and those who are holding out on it, I think that they will have to engage in a kind of a robust argument. Because one of the things that has also changed is, you know, when Musharraf sacked the judges, that was very different from Ziaul Haq sacking the judges. The Pakistani public didn't know about Ziaul Haq having sacked the judges for about sort of 8, 10, 12 hours until the next morning when the newspapers appeared. And the newspapers were also controlled. Now, there's breaking news. And while sometimes the breaking news is broken news, the truth is that that there is a greater awareness. It is a different era. So I think that this time there are factors in play. Can the politicians make a massive mistake and create circumstances again for intervention? You cannot rule that out. But I think that there is greater awareness. Pakistanis have learned from their own history and from the history of other nations as well.
Ambassador Haqqani, I'd like you've quite properly focused a great deal on process, because at the end of the day, democratic government is a process. But I'm going to ask you to try to walk at least a few steps down the road of what the process is leading to, and what comes out the other end of the pipeline, so to speak. And I'd like to focus on the war on terror, or as one should perhaps more properly say, the insurgency in Pakistan and its impact on Afghanistan. Certainly the last time I visited Pakistan, everyone I spoke with was acutely conscious of the dangers to Pakistan from the activities of the Pakistani Taliban and the suicide bombers. And this seemed to me to be a very high priority. For the U.S., the big priority is controlling the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. But these are two sides of the same coin. Where do you see this process going? Where do you see the policy going? What are the things that you believe this government can do that would become a more effective response? I'm trying to stay away from this dreadful phrase about whether Pakistan has or has not, quote-unquote, done enough. But I think everyone can agree that the results are not very happy so far. How do you get to better results?
As far as this, the doing more sort of Pakistan needs to do more mantra, I would say that the United States, NATO, Afghanistan, and Pakistan all need to do more. And I think that that is, in a nutshell, is what the solution of the elected government is for the problem. I think that what we have seen as difficulties in the border areas, both on the Afghan side and the Pakistan side, on both sides of the border, there have been problems, and those problems need a cooperative effort between Afghanistan and Pakistan on the one hand, and between NATO, the United States, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. And a major step was taken in that direction when the tripartite meeting was held day before yesterday in Kabul. I mean, in fact, the day General Musharraf resigned as president is the day that the Pakistan Army Chief went off to Kabul to be part of this tripartite meeting. So I think that the difference between the elected government and the previous order is going to be that now there will be an effort to fight terrorism because we need to fight terrorism, not because we need to use terrorism as the legitimizer for the government. In case of the previous holder of office in Pakistan, he did need the war against terror to tell the world that he was their ally. Now there will be a lot less political manipulation and a lot more action. And there will be specifics that will be worked out between, I mean, everybody knows about the chemistry or lack thereof between President Musharraf and President Karzai. And I think that the elected leadership and President Karzai will be able to work together much better. I think that the local leadership in various parts of the tribal areas, as well as Northwest Frontier Province and Balochistan, will be far more cooperative in targeted actions. And there will be a better understanding of what needs to be done, who needs to be fought, who needs to be talked to, and who needs to be brought on board. And I think that is what we will see as time goes by. Those are the dynamics, those are the mechanics. The most important ones being the cooperative relationship between NATO, the United States, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, and the second, there being a strategic plan for the entire region that has a political component, a socioeconomic component, and a military component, not just sporadic military action, which we saw in the past.
Well, let me throw questions open to the floor. I see that Arno already has his hand up, so let me invite him first, and then I'm going to ask Rick to be the arbiter of questions.
Arno de Borgraf, CSIS. Ambassador, you talked about the military being out of politics at long last, but you haven't mentioned the how to get the military out of the economy, which I understand is a major problem in Pakistan.
I think that the two are interconnected. I think that the military, as it goes, as it focuses on its core function of being an institution of national security, that is under civilian, lawfully constituted civilian authority. A lot of those things that have become the issue of debate over the last few years, including the economic role, alleged economic role of the military, including the question of, you know, who decides policy on certain issues, I think all of that will start to change. But I think that that is all part of a process. And the most important thing there is the decision that the military's primary function will be and should be what it was meant to be. And very frankly, the number of military officers that are coming through Washington and before that in Islamabad and Rawalpindi that I met, the number of people who now recognize, you know what, you people are probably right. Maybe we are not trained for certain things. This whole notion that being in the military is enough to run the country, that you somehow know everything as a result, I think that that has changed. In fact, the last 1 year when President... Because, you know, as I keep saying, look at the detail. I mean, for the first time, people started questioning the military as an institution, and that is not a good thing for Pakistan. That was not a good thing for the Pakistani military. And that has been a major reason. People didn't like, the military itself didn't like, you saw all the role played by the retired military officers, the Retired Servicemen's Association. They were concerned that instead of the military remaining an institution of admiration or an object of admiration for Pakistanis, it shouldn't become an object of criticism and ridicule and opposition from the people. And so I think that all of those factors have shaped the military's view and will continue to shape the military's view. It'll take, as I keep saying, it'll take time. And while that happens, I think that the military's withdrawal from politics and economics is both going to be affected.
I'm going to move it around the room. Can we get the gentleman in the back? And please wait for the microphone and identify yourself, if you would, and keep your questions
Yeah, my name is Kami Bhakt. I write for the Pakistani Spectator. Ambassador Haqqani, since you are talking about domestic situation, so I would like to ask you a question that I asked a couple of months ago to Atzaz Hassan at Amnesty International. My question is, did they put Zardari for 8 years in prison because he is not Punjabi, or they put him in prison because he is a corrupt? Atzaz Hassan's answer was not really answer. He said that Pakistani government spent so much money they couldn't prove anything against him. So my question to you is this, that if he was corrupt and he was put in jail, then he shouldn't make it a personal issue and he should reinstate the judge, Iftikhar Chowdhury. But if he was not corrupt, then and if I'm Zardari, I will never support Iftikhar Chowdhury. And my second question is about...
Let's have one question to a customer. We have an awful lot of people who want to ask.
Thanks.
I think that I have tremendous regard for Ehtezaz Hassan, and I'm not going to attempt to trump his answer to you. In the end, the question of corruption should be determined by the courts. And in case of politicians, the only other court other than the judicial process is the court of public opinion. Mr. Zardari has not been convicted by either. So therefore, I think that the subject, that your opinions on this matter, I'm happy to read them in Pakistan Spectator, but I don't think that they should animate or be the basis of how how the leader of the Pakistan People's Party should be viewed by his constituents, or how he should be limited in his actions. I think that the fact that somebody is not convicted by a court of law should carry some weight. As far as the restoration of the judges is concerned, I don't think Mr. Zardari or anybody's view on the matter is a function of their personal issues. I think it is a function of a genuine concern about the outcome. I think that there are some people who think that the judges can be restored by executive fiat, and some people who think that if the judges are restored, we will end up having two judiciaries, because the judges that were appointed to replace the Supreme Court judges may turn around and say, But you know what? We are the lawfully constituted court. And so therefore, there will be two Supreme Courts. And some people say we need to avoid that. It's a debate. It's a subject on which there are two opinions. But Mr. Kami, but I would like to say something to you as a fellow Pakistani. For too long, Pakistanis have debated politics as if it was a black and white issue in which their opinion is white and others' opinion is black. I think it's time to understand that there are always two views on politics, and sometimes both can be equally valid. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Ambassador Haqqani, the one big issue that you didn't touch on, of course, from my perspective, is the Indo-Pakistani relations, especially now that, again, there's been some turmoil in the Kashmir Valley. Thank you.
Actually, I'd seen you in the audience, so I knew that I don't have to talk about it. You'll raise it. India and Pakistan have been engaged in composite dialogue. India and Pakistan have... Look, General Musharraf, before him Nawaz Sharif, and before him Benazir Bhutto, all Pakistani leaders have attempted to improve relations with India. And the elected government has been very clear about how it sees a future in which Pakistan and India will be partners and friends rather than as permanent adversaries. I think that the source of what is the turmoil that is happening in the Indian-controlled parts of Kashmir, the source of that may actually be located in that region itself. After all, it has happened at almost a few-year intervals for many, many years. This is not militancy, that there are armed infiltrators. Some of it has been political. And so I think that it would be in the interest of all concerned if it is seen, if its real reasons of domestic political reasons are found. That said, the government of Pakistan remains committed to continuing with the composite dialogue. And I think that there is no appetite in Pakistan to use methods of the past, which brought India and Pakistan to the brink before. I think there is tremendous goodwill in Pakistan towards wanting a solution of all outstanding disputes with India, and a desire to continue with the composite dialogue process with the objective of having a good, friendly, neighborly relationship. In fact, the chairman of the Pakistan People's Party, Mr. Asif Zardari, is on record as saying that the two biggest achievements he seeks in the tenure of the new government is a good relationship with Afghanistan and a good relationship with India. That said, I think that the Indian side also needs to reevaluate and how to make Pakistanis feel more secure vis-a-vis India. There are people in Pakistan who remain very concerned. I am glad that they are not the ones who are making the decisions right now, but there are people in Pakistan, and I think reassurance is as important in international relations as deterrence. So I think that the India-Pakistan relationship will improve if India is able to convince Pakistanis and large numbers of Pakistanis that India does not have any ill will towards Pakistan. Pakistan has no ill will towards India. At least the elected leadership has made that very clear.
Thank you. I'm Howard Schaefer, Georgetown University. You said you would be going to the Democratic Convention in Denver, and I assume that you'll be going on in the interest of nonpartisanship to Minnesota. How do you see Pakistan coming up in the American presidential campaign?
Well, Ambassador Schaefer, you would probably agree with me. You would probably agree with me that it is not appropriate for an ambassador to comment on the domestic political developments of the host country. That said,
at least not in front of the microphone.
That said, let me just say that the Prime Minister of Pakistan during his recent visit met with the Democratic presidential presumptive nominee, Senator Barack Obama, and he had a telephone conversation with Senator McCain. And it is The fact that Pakistan now looks at its relationship with the United States as a relationship between two democracies and not just as a transactional relationship makes us very interested in the domestic political process of the United States, and we look forward to working with either. We have friends, Pakistan has friends, counts as friends, people on the campaigns of both. The advisors, especially those relating to South Asia, they are people that we talk to, we work with, and we really look forward to sharing ideas with them, explaining our position to them, and listening to them. The only thing I would say is that Pakistan is an important country in that region. It's a significant ally of the United States historically, and a country that really looks forward to remaining a friend, ally, and partner of the United States. It is unfortunate when people start characterizing it as a problem rather than as a partner. And I hope that the domestic political compulsions of the American domestic political discourse will not result in casting Pakistan in terms that those contesting the election will find it difficult to deal with the issues later, meaning creating a kind of an image that, you know, they don't like Pakistan or whatever. Because very frankly, you have dealt with Pakistan for many years. Pakistan and the United States, we are like a couple that disagrees enormously, but we're not about to leave each other. So might as well come to terms with that reality, and try to sort of make breakfast entertaining.
Patrick Moore with the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy. Ambassador Haqqani, I was wondering if you might speculate about the future of madrasas in Pakistan and the potential for reform.
Well, the madrasas have been an institution for several hundred years in South Asia. They have been identified as a source of problem, only a handful of them in recent years. I think that the Pakistani educational system needs to be invigorated in a manner in which more and more children are able to go to school. It is unfortunate that only 58% of school-going age children in Pakistan go to school. So I think that the government's plan to invest in education and the Biden-Lugar proposed legislation, which would triple non-military assistance to Pakistan and provide it the means to invest in its educational system, will definitely go a long way in improving our whole overall educational environment. And the madrasa component of it will definitely be one of the areas that will be a major focus of reform. And that reforms includes making children who study in madrasas grow up as tolerant young people with open minds and the ability to process information without bigotry.
Alyssa Ayers, now with McLarty Associates. Ambassador Haqqani, I wonder if you can comment a little bit on the time trade-offs involved with political processes and their shuffling and contentious debates as they're unfolding versus the issues of getting down to governance and getting down to tackling some of the big challenges that Pakistan does face. Is there a time horizon during which you would tell your American friends and well-wishers that, you know, we should be looking for within 3 to 4 months people getting down to business on matters of governance in the tribal areas or working towards educational reform in 6 to 8 months? Do you have any sort of time horizon? Is the coalition discussing a strategic plan like that?
First of all, I don't agree with the characterization that the two are mutually exclusive. I think they can take place at the same time. Most nations are capable and most human beings are capable of chewing gum and walking straight at the same time, and so are governments. They can have politics and they can have policy at the same time. I think that the biggest hurdle to a coherent policy until now was the much more fundamental divide which was not just between coalition partners, but between a presidency that was considered to be lacking in legitimacy and the debates relating to that. So I think the sooner we are able to put behind legitimacy issues, the easier it will be for us to get to the business of governance. I expect the questions about legitimacy to be resolved within weeks, not months. And I think that the process of governance has already started. I think that the Prime Minister and his cabinet have started making critical decisions. I think once the decision is made by one of the major partners in the coalition to return their ministers to the cabinet or not return them to the cabinet, whichever the decision is, you can't have 9 ministries without full-time ministers for indefinite periods. So they will either come to the cabinet again or will be replaced. Whatever the decision is taken after that, I think we will be in full-time governance mode. So I don't think this is it's not that we will not be able to govern just because we are having politics. Policy and politics can function at the same time. There will be periods when one will look more dominant than the other, but I don't think that this is something in which there will be indefinite paralysis.
Ambassador Haqqani, you had talked about Constitution.
Could you identify yourself, please?
I'm Elfrida Gill. I'm from Maryland, working for the governor of Maryland for the Asian Americans. You had mentioned about the process and the Constitution. And what my question is focused towards the minorities in Pakistan. I know the 295C. How is the present elected government going to create strategies to handle 295C?
You mean Article 295C of the Constitution?
Yes, the 295C, Article 295C.
You have to translate it for the people what 295C means in general terms before I can answer the question.
Well, 295C, of course, it's always focused on the minorities of Pakistan, whereas the blasphemy law, in other
basically,
words, the blasphemy.
Basically, Article 295C is essentially the constitutional cover for blasphemy laws. And the amendment of Pakistan's constitution is not an easy process. Unfortunately, the last two military regimes, that of General Ziaul Haq and the one of General Musharraf, have both done something that was not done in the preceding two military regimes, which is Ayub Khan gave his own constitution but then abrogated it before he left. Ziaul Haq and General Musharraf restored constitutions after amending them enormously and adding, and 295C is one of the amendments that was introduced. That's why it's C rather than A or B, because it was added on under General Ziaul Haq. I think that the minorities of Pakistan actively participated in this election, voted overwhelmingly. Most of them supported the political parties that have won the election. Minority representatives are very significant, especially in the PPP. The PPP got a significant portion of the minority vote. And there is a commitment to religious minorities, to women, and to the dispossessed and the poor. Will Article 295C be the first priority of the government? I will not be able to say indefinite terms, for the simple reason that amending a constitution takes 2/3 in both houses of parliament. But will the application of blasphemy laws in a manner in which they discriminate against minorities come to an end? That is certainly a priority for the government.
My name is Ghazia and I'm a Pakistani student here. My question is about the judges issue. You said that there is a consensus that the judges should be reinstated, but there is not a consensus on the modalities. I think that both the political parties have agreed twice on how they want to reinstate the judges. And in both the resolutions, they actually gave a time frame. The legal mind of the country are on a consensus. There is a consensus among people as well, which is pretty much shown by the long march, where hundreds of thousands of people participated. So I don't understand where the problem is coming from.
There are too many assumptions in your question. There weren't hundreds of thousands of people in the Long March. The official count was 30,000. In any case, a demonstration, even if there were hundreds of thousands, there's 160 million people in Pakistan, and the people voted. And the people who claim that they have the mandate, it's very interesting, and I didn't want to say this because I just praised somebody a few minutes ago in a question, but the point is people who boycotted the election turn around and then say that the election results should manifest the mandate for our position is a little contradictory in itself. I think in the end, the elected leadership has the mandate of the people. As far as the judges are concerned, I understand people when I was a young activist at one time, and the judges issue definitely galvanized a lot of young Pakistanis for the first time after a long time into political activism. So they feel that their view and the people they look upon as leaders is the only valid view. That is not true. Pakistan has a constitutional system under which parliament should make the decision, and those who think or have a certain point of view, they should have run for election, got those votes, and proven that they have the mandate. They can't use protests and demonstrations to bypass the mandate that was given to parliament. The two major political parties have agreed twice to restore judges. On no occasion have they agreed on a formula through which judges will be restored. One side continuously maintains that the judges should be restored through executive fiat, and the other party has always maintained that the judges should be restored through a parliamentary process. And that is something that is on the record. That said, the judges, once they are reinstated or restored, will put this problem behind us. But very frankly, no single political party in Pakistan, especially the one that has fewer seats than the other, has the right to dictate to others what their opinion and position should be.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. Mr. Ambassador, you pointed out correctly, obviously, that the extremist parties did worse in the last election than in the previous election. But at the same time, the strength of the Taliban seems to be growing, more and more insurgents. How do you explain the apparent disconnect, lower support in elections, but growing insurgent strength on the ground?
I think that the insurgency is not necessarily popular, and just because they are able to recruit more people to fight is not necessarily an indication of having more support from the people.
I'm in at CSIS. Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. I wonder if I could go back to your point about chewing gum and walking simultaneously. In the last 6 months since the election, I've been reading the press almost every day, and there's not a lot of material in there about what you would call the non-legitimacy issues, the economy, manufacturing, agriculture, etc. Yet the rupee has been falling, the economy has been slowing, etc. I wonder if you could expand a bit on where you see the parties going, either both or together or separately, on some fundamental economic performance questions. Because otherwise they'll be fighting on these legitimacy questions, and pretty soon the legitimacy of parties may be lost.
Look, immediately after the election, the agreement between the Pakistan Muslim League N and the PPP was that the PPP will have national security ministries involving because the twin concerns were concerns of social democratic issues. And the PMLN will have the economic ministries. The PMLN because they had a reputation for being the free market, sort of pro-business party. And it was a functional division. The PMLN decided at one point to withdraw its ministers over the judges issue. And that resulted in creating a vacuum on the economic in the economic portfolios in cabinet. So every minister ended up having more than one portfolio, which is why you have seen less press on the subject. Doesn't mean those ministries are not running. I think that within the next few days, this matter is going to be resolved. We will have those ministers either back in cabinet or a decision will be taken one way or the other. And then the cabinet will be able to execute policy which it has already formulated. There is a basic document that the PMLN and the PPP agreed to, which was the basic or the common minimum platform. And in that there are certain targets set on the economic front. And I personally feel that as soon as the presidential election is held and this matters, these matters of legitimacy are resolved, we will see more of effective and serious decisions taken on the subject of the economy. The one thing that did happen after the election is that the government was able to present and secure the approval of the budget from Parliament. And the budget was considered generally favorably. The reason why we have seen an erosion of the value of the rupee and certain uncertainty in the market is because of the overall uncertainty in the politics. And I think that immediately after General Musharraf's resignation, the stock exchange certainly picked up and the rupee's erosion of value was also slowed. Pakistan does have twin deficits to contend with, the fiscal deficit as well as the balance of payments deficit. And I think that there are very specific measures that have been agreed to by the government and the donor community. And I think that we will see sort of public presentations on that score in the not-so-distant future.
Thank you for coming and speaking here, Ambassador Haqqani. My name is Taha with the Pakistani American Leadership Center. Our offices have worked very closely in advocating for the Biden-Lugar bill, and we thank you for your leadership on that. It's obviously something very necessary. And one of the things you said about that bill is that it provides the means to invest in Pakistan's education system. And I think that's exactly correct. And I think also that Pakistani Americans are a little bit ahead of the curve of our government in investing in Pakistani education, particularly in an organization called the National Commission for Human Development, which is a public-private partnership with the government of Pakistan. Recently, that organization got defunded, and it was providing 8 million Pakistanis with education. It was employing 87,000 Pakistanis. So my question for you is, given that this organization was doing such strong development work and education work and working on primary health care, why would the government at this point, and if it had a problem with the management of the organization, it audited the governor, the Auditor General of Pakistan audited this organization, but if you have a problem with the responsiveness of this organization to the civilian government, if you have a problem with the management, go ahead, change the management, reform the system, but don't defund the organization. So what steps are you taking to get that funding back and maybe make the reforms that you think that the government of Pakistan should make in regards to this organization? Thank you.
I think that the matter of the National Commission for Human Development and its relationship with the government is something that is under the consideration of the government at the moment. It's a very specific question that only those who know what the NCHD is and what the issues involved are would be able to know the answer. But certainly the functions of the NCHD in relation to promoting healthcare and education in Pakistan are functions that the government of Pakistan respects and appreciates, and I'm sure that an amicable solution will be found to the disagreements that exist within Pakistan about the organizational mechanisms through which the NCHD has worked so far.
My name is Omar Adam. I'm a lawyer from NWFP Peshawar. I have a head office there. I'm here on a holiday and took the opportunity of coming and joining this.
Not a very good way to spend your holiday, sir. You could have done much better.
That's the dilemma, you see. Okay. I come also from a military background, and you mentioned that one of the reasons the army stayed away from the political process this time was to avoid ridicule. I think if you look back, all political parties, or once their terms were abruptly ended, or all military personnel who took over power through coup d'etats, sweets have been distributed one way or the other, at every end, at every beginning. This time, I think personally, and from my interaction with the military officers, is that the army had a much bigger problem this time. The army was facing revolt from a local civilian, a man on the street, because the hatred for the army in the Pakistan has come to a level where they would have been thrashed in the streets by the locals. The vehicles would have been burnt. It's one of the reasons the army vehicles are not allowed to be stuck in traffic jams. Army personnel are not allowed to wear uniforms in public for the sole reasons for their policies, for the hatred, or for the they haven't been able to explain their actions to the people of Pakistan. They have been doing acts where they have not been able to explain to the people. The army has an opportunity, they've messed it up. The politicians have had an opportunity, they've messed it up. The mullahs have had an opportunity.
So help us with the question.
Messed
here.
It up, right?
Yeah.
The question now is, what next? The chances are, once you do not deliver on the judges issue, you do not deliver on tribal areas or killing your own people issue, you do not deliver on economics, food, roads, schooling, healthcare, anything. There has to be another revolution, and there will be another revolution. And people like us, the younger generation, are going to come and ask you, what have you done? What are you doing here? We're going to ask America.
Plan to ask me, ask it in brief. I think the audience will definitely appreciate that.
No, of course, because I'm not getting an answer, because I want an answer, clear-cut answer. You see?
Okay.
So if you exactly.
Okay,
so the question is, do you have a strategy of all these issues? Judges' issue is not an issue which is political. A country in 60
years... Could you wind up, please?
60 years at least, we need... You know, in 60 years, a country can have a judiciary at least. I mean, we live in a country where there's no judiciary.
Could you please, sir, wind up so the ambassador can answer you?
Do you have any answers?
The question,
that's my question.
The question
is, do you
was
have any answers?
Yes, I do. And my answer to your spirited statement is that is definitely an opinion. And what Pakistanis are learning, and I think a majority of Pakistanis has learned, is that there is above all a need for a system whereby we can voice our opinions and the views of the majority can prevail. I think that's what we are trying to build. I think that the sentiment that somehow, I've heard this revolution speech since I was 6 years old also, by the way. So I've heard it for at least more than 4.5 decades. I think the important thing is, even revolutions come about through commitment to ideas. And what we have is, we have a complex society, we have a complex reality on ground, and there are always a handful of people who are not willing to sit down and look at the complexities and look at solutions that always come one piece at a time. So it's very easy to sit down and talk dismissively. No one's performed, nothing's happened, everything's bad, etc., etc. It never is. Since 1947, Pakistan has come a long way. Since in every government, civilian or military, good or bad, there are issues that have either been resolved or the country has moved forward. At the same time, the fundamental issue has been resolving the mechanisms for running the country. A political system, a stable political system, is always the most important method of solving other problems. And I think Pakistan is on the way to developing a stable political system. But in the final analysis, whether you agree with politics, whether you don't, whether you think politicians are bad, then become one yourself. I think that that is what democracy requires. I think there are just too many people in Pakistan, and as ambassador, I want to say it in the most polite of ways, who just sit and dismissively say everybody is a failure without acknowledging that if others are failures, they should rise up to the plate and take over. No one stops people who disagree with the existing group of Pakistani politicians to replace them. But you will have to then persuade millions of Pakistanis to vote for you and support you. And I think that the military withdrawing from politics has opened the path for Pakistan to have a viable, sustainable political system. That political system will have, even the most advanced democracies have performance issues. But those performance issues are resolved within the framework of democracy, within the framework of the political system that has been developed. And I think that that is where Pakistan is headed and should remain headed.
I think we have time for about four more questions. Let's get the gentleman in the blue shirt here first, and then we'll give one more for each section.
Thank you for an interesting set of talk and set of responses. I'm Christopher Chivas from the RAND Corporation. I want to ask you to elaborate a little bit more on what you've said about health and education policy in Pakistan, which is, I think, increasingly emerging as a as a security issue, in addition to a development issue. I wonder what you see, just in general terms, as being the main challenges ahead for your country, and how you think perhaps a democratic government, a civilian government, may be a better place to meet those challenges in the future.
Pakistan's greatest challenge is to make sure that all school-going age children have access to schooling, that fundamental healthcare issues are resolved. And I think that that is a challenge that the government hopes to meet. There will be resource constraints, but it's also a question of allocating resources and giving it a priority. It's interesting that notwithstanding the debates that we have had in Pakistan year after year, the fact remains that under civilian governments, Pakistan's healthcare and educational spending has always increased, and there is a functional reason for it. It's not because the civilian governments are more noble and whatever. It's a political reason. You want to go back to the people to get votes in the next election, you have to show them something. And what you need to show is the school you put up in their village, the health center you built in their cluster of in their small town. You have to do it for the people. It's interesting that in 1947, when Pakistan became independent, Pakistan's literacy rate was 16%. India's literacy rate was 18%. India's literacy rate is now 68%. Pakistan, which has had intermittent civil and military rule, has not been able to have the same level of literacy rates. So I think it's a question, it's a function of politics, where political power lies. And I think when the political power lies with people who are elected from the people, then the chances that they will allocate more resources for healthcare and education are greater. There is always, of course, the possibility of some of those resources being squandered in patronage, and that possibility always remains. But I think, by and large, given the will of the elected representatives and the fact that the international community, for example, the Biden-Lugar legislation being a case in point, the international community is also recognizing that perhaps Pakistan will be a more stable and secure country if it will have a population, a greater majority of which has access to education and healthcare.
Ambassador, why don't we cluster three quick questions here and let you decide how you're going to essay them, if you would, okay? So this gentleman here in the front, if we could, and then we'll go to this gentleman there, and then we'll go to that gentleman over there. You seem to be the most eager at this point.
Thank you. I'm Leonard Oberlander, Consulting International Liaison. As a democracy in transition, how would you see Pakistan's development future as regards regional institutions and Pakistan's participation in those as part of its effort to have good relations with its neighbors? And particularly, for example, in areas of energy, power development, electricity transmission, aircraft, aviation, ground transportation, and infrastructure. Thank you.
State University. Ambassador Haqqani, how do the current political representatives that were elected in February, how do they differ from past representatives? Are they simply a reflection of the same groups that have always controlled Pakistan?
Surrounded by microphones.
Mr. Haqqani, I'm a Pakistani origin American working with the World Bank here. I must congratulate Pakistan on the recent developments that have taken place, and I think Pakistanis have shown that they are willing to face the challenges which lie ahead. They have to take care of the institutions and strengthen the civilian institutions, political institutions in Pakistan. But what I find here is there's a lot of cynicism about Pakistan in the U.S. You talk to everybody, either they think I'm sitting next to them, I may be a terrorist. And when you talk about Pakistan's action, they say they have not done enough, they should have done enough. When we explain to them that more Pakistanis being dying over there for the sake of fighting terrorism, they hardly believe that. My question to you, sir, is that what is the strategy of you as an ambassador here to change this perspective? Because you are not as familiar with the street sort of reaction to Pakistan as we are as we walk in the streets and see that we are looked down upon as something to stay away from. We are considered as, and it suits some lobbies here to project Pakistan this way so that they can benefit from that. So I would like to know from you, sir, what is your strategy? How are you going to handle this? Because this is going to be a major issue here. Elections coming, new government coming, new people coming in, and people have to know better what really Pakistan is. Thank you.
By answering the last question first, it's not a very difficult question to answer. I have learned, by the way, I have also spent a great deal of time walking the streets of Washington, D.C. and all the way to Boston, actually, so I am familiar with the cynicism. But I think that one must recognize that the cynicism actually also comes from, you heard from a young man from Pakistan who sounded as cynical about Pakistan as anybody in Washington, D.C. would be. I think that the way to change the perception of Pakistan is by changing some of those foundations on which that cynicism rests. And I think that by changing the political system, by making our society more open to open debate, I think we will change the ground realities in Pakistan. And once we start changing those ground realities in Pakistan, people will start giving Pakistan the respect we deserve as a nation. I think that not having representative institutions has been a major, major reason for cynicism about Pakistan. Having governments that operate in secrecy rather than in open has been a reason for people to believe that Pakistan, that there are wheels within wheels in Pakistan. So the more open our government, the more open our processes, the greater our willingness amongst ourselves to disagree and respect each other. Not necessarily think that, you know, if he doesn't agree with me, he must be a bad man. The greater Pakistan is able to project itself as a modern democratic society and nation, the less cynicism there will be about Pakistan. And within Pakistan also, we have to bring to an end the cynicism. Look, no country has a perfect political system. No country on a day-to-day basis has perfection in its leadership. There are issues everywhere. And the important thing is that most nations have a method and a system through which they address them. Pakistan has alternated between civil and military rule, and then within democracy also, we have never given our leaders a chance to complete their terms. And then there is this endless debate about, you know, but our politicians are feudal, our military lacks legitimacy. The debate of who should rule Pakistan has been made into an endless debate. I think that needs to be resolved. Those who are voted in by the people will be the ones who will rule the country, and when they are voted out, they will leave office. And that will be the process. It works for our neighbors, it should work for us, and it will. I think Professor Kochanik's question, there are some elements in Pakistan's elected leadership that are permanent. There are districts from which and regions from which certain people or families manage to get elected on a regular basis. And there are places where people, the representation changes. So the short answer to your question is that Pakistan's parliament is actually a microcosm of the changes that have taken place, the change and continuity in Pakistani society. Many of the cities now are represented by representatives of a very different quality and different nature than the rural areas. And in the rural areas too, it's different. A different level of people, far more educated membership of parliament right now, many more women, both directly elected and those who have been elected indirectly through reserved seats, and a lot more younger people. In fact, one of the interesting developments is that instead of the elderly who used to, you know, the family patriarch coming into parliament, many families of wielding regional and local influence have chosen to put up the younger members for election. So I think that is the new makeup of parliament. And more important than anything else, in the last 4 months, the parliament has met for more hours than it used to in the past, has done more legislation than it used to do in the past, and has had a more open process of debate. More voices have been heard. That said, I think what I call the Ayub Khan critique, which is, you know, Pakistan is inherently unsuited to parliamentary democracy, etc., etc., there are those who will continue to make that. But I think that once the process goes on and a second parliament comes and a third comes, I think the membership of that whole institution will start evolving and changing. In this country, there are states where I can cite some, but there was a long time in Louisiana when you couldn't be governor of the state without having the name long at the end of your name. So, I mean, you know, that reality exists in some parts of Pakistan too. But I think if we persist with the parliamentary system, we will be able to change the makeup over time. And the first question, which is a more complex question, I think that Pakistan and Pakistan's elected leadership is very aware of the fact that Pakistan's greatest economic advantage is its location. It sits on the crossroads of South Asia, the Gulf, and Central Asia. And if we can just open up the whole political disputes and bring them to either an end or at least put them on the back burner, we can be the energy corridor for that region. We can certainly be an important trading a nation. We can certainly be a nation that can benefit from the economic needs of all of our four major neighbors, China, India, Afghanistan, and Iran. And I think that that is definitely something that is part of the vision. But as you know, translating vision into policy takes time, and a lot of factors have to be in place before a vision can be translated into policy. So is there a specific policy addressing all your questions? Some of them, yes. Some of them in the making. Some of them, no. But is there a vision? Definitely. And that vision is that Pakistan will be economically more vibrant if it actually has a closer relationship with all its neighbors. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much to Ambassador Haqqani for sharing his afternoon with us and to all of you for being here.